back here with my younger brother.
Right. Yes.
And we have the same advice through Lawrence Hall. And now he's at the Williams College. He will tell us about kinder physics of neutrino dark matter.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me here. It's a real pleasure to be here. This is work. This is stuff that I've been thinking about recently with Spencer Chang and Neil Weiner. So there are lots of ideas out there for physics beyond the standard model. The leading candidate still probably is supersymmetry, and there are some good reasons why people find supersymmetry compelling. It stabilizes the Higgs potential, which is quadratically sensitive to ultraviolet physics in the standard model. If you have weak scale supersymmetry, then to very good precision, the gauge couplings meet at high energies to much better precision than they do in the standard model. And the third thing is that in the simplest realistic SUSY theories, that is ones where you don't have tons of left-hand variant number violation, you have something called R parity, which guarantees that the lightest superpartner is going to be stable and so has the potential to be a good dark matter candidate. So in supersymmetry, the most obvious ones to think about for dark matter are the ones that are weakly interacting in neutral. That leads you to the neutralino and this neutrino. Of course, when people talk about SUSY dark matter, they don't usually talk about neutrinos. Why is that? Well, they focus on neutralinos for pretty good reasons, because if you calculate the relic abundance of a neutrino LSP, you find that these annihilation processes are very efficient. And so to get an interesting abundance, you either need a very light neutrino of order GeV or so, or an unusually heavy one around TeV scale. Now, the problem with the light neutrino, of course, is that these things couple to the Z, so constraints on the Z width don't allow you to have such a light neutrino, and direct detection experiments rule out this larger one. Okay, so there are good reasons for focusing on neutralino and dark matter, but on the other hand, there are some pretty simple ways to get around the problems I just described for neutrino dark matter, and I want to describe some of these. The first way, which is the way I'll be focusing on today, is to have a situation where you introduce right-handed neutrino superfields into the MSSM, but you don't let them get super heavy. Okay, so they're in the low energy theory, and for now, let's just imagine that they don't have a Majorana mass at all. Okay? So just think about lepton number being conserved. Interesting things happen if you allow SUSY breaking to feed into the scalars here in certain ways. For example, suppose you have an A term, LNH, which is weak scale. Okay. So I'm imagining that you have a Dirac neutrino mass, which therefore has a tiny, tiny Yukawa coupling, but a weak scale A term. Okay. If you have such a thing, then when you look at the 2x2 mass matrix for the right-handed neutrino and the left-handed neutrino, you have these soft SUSY breaking masses squared, D term, and then this generates a mixing, right, between the left-handed and right-handed neutrinos. There it is, AB sine of it. And so the mass eigenstates are linear combinations of the left-handed and right-handed things. Here's the lightest one, which contains sine theta times the left-handed. So I need, I'm saying that there's no NN term in the superpotential, even though these things are gauge singlets, right? So that's mysterious. I'm saying that the coefficient of this gauge invariant LNH term in the superpotential is really small to give me the right size neutrino mass. Those things are both mysterious, I admit that. On the other hand, in the MSSM, you have questions like, why is the H of H down coefficient so small? Right, that's a new problem. So these issues are not without precedent. And there you can imagine that there's some symmetry which forbids that coupling, and you only generate an effective new term after SUSY breaking. Maybe you generate an effective Yukawa coupling after SUSY breaking as well. So let's just imagine that some symmetry just for business thing, and then if we have a spurion pair x and x bar, look at this in the Kähler potential. If x develops an F term BEV here, then this looks like an effective Yukawa coupling. And this is some higher dimension operator, so you get a suppression of the Yukawa coupling if you need to. Small. This thing, on the other hand, when I put in an F term here, I get an LNH A term. That's roughly weak scale. So this is exactly what I was working with in the previous transparency. It's crucial here that this spurion doesn't develop a large A term BEV, because if it did, then right here is a very, very big Yukawa coupling, and the neutrino mass is actually big. So this is a situation where lepton numbers conserved, you have pure Dirac neutrino masses and potentially large mixing between the lepton and right-hand neutrinos. I won't go into too much, but you can also do something similar. Use Suzy breaking in a similar way to have Majorana neutrino masses, where instead of just having a pure F-term BEV here, you let the A-term BEV be of the same energy scale. Okay. And that gives you too large a neutrino mass, it looks like, but then if you generate, if you have a Suzy breaking give you a weak scale lepton number violating mass for the right-handed neutrinos, then you can have a weak scale seesaw.
Could you briefly remind me what a spurion is?
Yeah, so this thing is my way of sort of being lame and not telling you what my model of Suzy breaking is. I'm just saying there's some hidden sector of Suzy breaking, and I'm coupling, I'm encoding the effects of Suzy breaking through higher dimension operators with fields that encode Suzy breaking.
Okay.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that lepton number violation possibility for reasons that will become clear soon. Okay. In any case, so for this talk, really though, it's phenomenology. So this is all you need to care about. I'm just going to mix the left hand and right hand neutrinos through this A term. Okay. What does this have to do with dark matter? Well, it's not too hard to guess, right? Because let's go back to the Z width constraint. This Z couples to SNU left, SNU left. SNU left contains sine theta times SNU 1, right? So this vertex now has a sine squared theta in front of it. And the partial width of Z into this lightest neutrino is proportional to sine to the fourth. So left tells us that this partial width has to be less than 2 MeV. But even if I set this neutrino mass to 0, that's okay as long as sine theta is less than about 0.4.
Okay. See, is there a SNU right coupling?
No, there's not.
Just because it's singlet.
It's just
because
it's singlet,
right?
Yeah.
But after mixing, I mean,
in that basis, the left-right basis, there's a left-left coupling and not a right-right coupling, right? Mm-hmm. And now in the mass eigenstate basis, there is a 1-1 coupling, a 1-2 coupling, and a 2-2 coupling.
Right.
And the 1-1 coupling goes as sine squared, 1-2 is sine cosine.
And so forth,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, right.
So what is the mass eigenstate 2? How heavy is that?
Oh, I'm going to imagine that it's heavy enough not to be relevant here. So you know,
okay, so there's no
like
problem
150, 200.
Mixing matrix.
No problem for the Z width.
And the mixing matrix with your parameter choices are such that eigenvalues comfortably.
Yeah, because remember I have this freedom.
Yeah.
I have this freedom to make this whatever I want.
Oh,
so,
I see.
There's a lot of control we have over the situation
okay.
here, for better or worse.
All right, so you're sort of, okay,
yeah.
Got it now.
Right. Yes. Right, okay. So this light neutrino case for dark matter is potentially interesting again. The direct detection limits also are effective, because here's the cross-section for neutrino scattering off of a nucleus. Now with the sine of the fourth in it, focusing on the dominant Z exchange diagram. And here is the current limit from CDMS. Okay. Obviously, it depends on the mass, but let's focus on this point right here, because this is you know 20 GeV, 100 GeV, right? If I require that I'm below this line, all I'm asking is for sine theta to be 0.11. Okay? So there's no constraint from CDMS if sine theta is that small. Okay. What else do I want to say here? We can even give ourselves more room to work with if we invoke some of this lepton number violation stuff that I mentioned. In that Majorana framework, you might have a soft mass of this form, right-handed neutrino, right-handed neutrino, as opposed to n tilde and n tilde star, right? A lepton number violating thing. And what that does is it splits the CP even and CP odd parts of this lightest neutrino. Okay? And let me call those SNU minus and SNU plus. It's just a fact that there is no vertex, SNU minus, SNU minus. So once that happens, the lightest neutrino can't scatter elastically. It has to scatter from SNU minus to SNU plus. If that mass splitting, though, is large enough, then think about these slow-moving neutrinos in the halo. When they try to scatter off of a nucleus, they just won't be able to. It will be kinematically forbidden. And in fact, the mass splitting doesn't need to be very big, just you know dozens of KeV, and you strongly suppress the scattering off of a germanium target set.
Are both eigenstates stable dark matter, or does one decay into the other?
In this case, one would decay in the other. How? Probably through a photon. And let's see. I've forgotten this, actually. Yeah, no. So the SNU plus will decay into SNU minus.
Is it automatically true that SNU plus is heavier than SNU minus?
I don't think it can be automatic. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so that's another choice. Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get straight.
Anyway.
See what determines that.
Right.
Anyway.
Right. Yeah. Anyway. So this all I'm saying here is that it's worth considering when you look at the collider physics. It's even worth considering larger values of sine theta, because it could be that there's some inelasticity which just gets around this. I'm not going to focus on that case today. I'm going to require us to be below this line, but I wanted to mention it. Okay. The sine theta factors certainly affect these constraints, but also the abundance calculation. If I go back to the calculation for the case of a really light neutrino, if it's light enough, then the abundance doesn't depend on the mass. And if you just assume that the Teach channel Wino exchange dominates, this is what omega h squared is, okay? And remember, it's light, so the sine theta has to be below 0.4. Think about this. This is to be around 0.1. Then already I see that I get a factor of half to the fourth here. It's a 16th. So it tells me that this had better not be too big. It tells me that the mass of this thing is ideally around 130 GeV or so. So before, the problem was that we just these things annihilate like crazy, right? And now the problem is that if this is 400 GeV or something, then with the sine theta suppression, you overclose. Okay, so you're sort of forced to take the Wino mass to be rather light. It's not you know ruled out or anything, but it's interesting that. Has to be rather light. Okay. Now, for a heavier neutrino where the CDMS constraint kicks in, remember for light enough neutrinos that constraint is not there, then we needed sine theta to be more like 0.1, so you might think that you're even more in danger of overclosing. But on the other hand, for a heavier neutrino, you can do things like decaying into an S channel Higgs through an S channel Higgs into W plus W minus. And so this H couples to SNU left, SNU right, as opposed to the Z, which coupled to SNU left, SNU left. So instead of a sine squared theta factor here, I've just got, it's kind of like sine cosine. it's really proportional to the A term times sine 2 theta. Okay? So this is not so so suppressed, especially if this neutrino is heavy enough that you can go into W's. Okay, so I've
So now you need... I should think of this as eigenstate, so you need...
Yes.
You need that the SNU left and SNU right not be that dissimilar in mass.
Well, I mean, so...
And then you're back into maybe a Z constraint on the scenario.
No, I don't... How is that? I mean, SNU left and SNU right, I'm not sure I see that.
Well, you're doing co-annihilation. Well,
I mean, the mass eigenstates are 1 and 2. Left and right, it doesn't even make sense to say that left has a mass.
Oh,
I mean, it's
oh,
just
okay,
some approximation.
Yeah, I see. So you're just dealing with the lightest. Okay, sorry.
Exactly.
Okay, I was confused.
That's all right.
Go ahead.
So here's a plot which, unfortunately, I didn't label. This is the A parameter. This is A in GeV. This is sine theta. And I'm fixing the lightest neutrino mass to be 100 GeV. Okay. So imagine you're going along at constant sine theta. I'm varying the A parameter. How do I vary the A parameter and keep all that stuff fixed? It's by varying the heaviest neutrino mass, right? The left-handed neutrino mass. Okay. And so as I go up here, the left-handed neutrino mass is getting higher and higher, and by the time I get up to here, it's about 450 GeV. This is an outdated plot before we knew what WMAP was going to tell us and that sort of thing. But let me just tell you that omega A squared of 0.1 is right around here. Okay, so this is where we want to live. Okay. And note that this is outdated also in the sense that CDMS has pushed me down to here. So the allowed region is actually over here. And in the point that I'm actually going to analyze in some detail later, you should think of us being right around here. I've just had time to analyze one point so far.
What is the Higgs mass? I mean, that also affects this.
Oh, no, that it certainly does. It's like it's light. It's like 120.
Okay, so you don't...
So there's
but,
no
but
pole
I mean
effects kind of going on.
But if you change the Higgs mass, or there are other Higgses floating around, all of
this... Yes, so this is in the decoupling limit. I recall we just took the decoupling limit and had a
okay,
light.
So this is standard model like Higgs,
yeah.
Nothing special about
exactly.
It, just above the left limit is what
right.
You're telling me. Okay.
Yeah. Yes, of course, once if you introduce inelasticity, then you can be out here, you can go to larger sine theta. Okay. But so what I'm really interested in talking about today is what the collider implications of this scenario might be. And just taking this region as the first point to look at. Let me quickly tell you about some other ideas for resurrecting neutrino dark matter, though, just because there are some and they're all kind of simple. What if you just introduce right-handed neutrinos in the MSSM with the appropriate tiny Yukawa coupling, and imagine that the A terms are as small as you might naively guess they'd be. Right, you guess they'd be Yukawa coupling times whatever neutrino mass or Susie breaking scale. Right, so that'd be a tiny A term. In that case, the right-handed, you know, the mass eigenstates are basically left-handed neutrino and right-handed neutrino. There's virtually no mixing between them, and those right-handed neutrinos are not thermalized in the early universe. Okay? But you can still produce them non-thermally. Through things like Higgs-Zeno decays and so forth. Because you have this Yukawa coupling, right? L and H in the superpotential, take the Higgs-Zeno from the H, and you can decay things like neutrino, neutrino, and so forth. So that's interesting, and the question is whether you get enough of these neutrinos for dark matter. And the answer is, basically, you don't, unless you go into some interesting regions. What you can do is take the left-handed and right-handed neutrino masses pretty close to each other. Then this tiny mixing that you have there, which is really tiny, is still large enough to occasionally get you decays of the standard model stuff, the MSSM stuff, to the right-handed neutrino. through this very tiny mix. So for example, here's, we know, coupling to right-hand neutrino, SNU1, basically. And neutrino. If this is really right-handed, I would never write this down, right? Because this is SU2 stuff. But this tiny mixing of the A terms can make this happen very occasionally. And so this coefficient A, this dimensionless thing, that's the thing that's basically in front of the neutrino-Yukawa coupling and this neutrino mass in what I would call the dimensionful A term. Okay, so you expect that to be order one, and they find that if this neutrino mass, the left and right neutrino mass, are close enough together, there's one that's at 100. Here's this is going from 100 to say 120 right here. Then that A term is large enough to give you enough mixing to decay into enough neutrinos to match with cosmological observations. This is what WMAP is wanting you to do, and these are the abundance results for different values of that A. So that's another interesting possibility. It's considered by this group and that group as well. So this must be right. This should be right hand neutrino. Yeah, sorry about that.
By the way, does the Higgs decay into these like eigenstates?
Could. Yeah, could. Not in this case, because this is the case
with
agents.
No, but I mean in your previous case.
Yeah, it could.
Case.
It could. There's some parameter region where it could.
Is it the dominant decay? I mean, there was.
I remember we first considered this, you know, a while ago, and I remember when we considered it, you had to kind of work to make it dominant, because the issues there are. I mean, you need a fairly large A term there, because that's the coupling, right? It's the elongation term. You need a fairly large A term, and yet you need this neutrino mass to be small enough for it to couple to. And then, what else was there? But the coupling is ultimately, that's right, the coupling is ultimately SNU left, SNU right. And so there needs to be enough mixing there on top of that for that decay to be enhanced. So there's some parameter region where it could occur. All right. Okay, in this kind of scenario where you have these really small Yukawa couplings, think about this right in its neutrino LSP. You have the MSSM, you have some lightest MSSM superpartner. It wants to decay to this right-handed neutrino, but it has only these really tiny couplings, Yukawa couplings, and A-terms to work with. And so you get lots of things like displaced vertices and tracks. This was looked at for the case of NLSP stops, so to stop right, where you have stop right decaying through an off-shell Higgs, say off-shell charge Higgs to bottom quark, actually off-shell charge Higgs xeno into bottom quark and right-handed neutrino and lepton. And so for these parameters, this is the Yukawa coupling here. For these parameters, this is the distribution of the transverse displacement of a stop at Pevatron and the LHC.
Sorry,
Could you
draw the diagram?
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I should have drawn it instead of sending. So you have stop right and Higgsino here and bottom quark and then SNU right here and left on here. So this, it could also be the top quark and the neutral Higgsino, but. Space. Okay. And so, indeed, you can easily get millimeter type displacements, and that's interesting. this group also considered something similar where you had stows instead. There you could get...
So how heavy does the pig xeno there have to be in order to...
Well, this is the 250 GB Higgs, you know, they were thinking about.
The new parameters.
Yeah, they were thinking of, there's no mixing cases.
Right, okay.
So, I mean, this Yukawa coupling is not what gives you Dirac and Trina mass. They were thinking of some weak scale seesaw type of thing, like I described before. If it's really ordinary, neutrino, Dirac neutrino, Yukawa coupling, then these NLSPs are just stable for collider purposes.
Let's see, why does the distribution change like that?
Because at the LHC, even though you have more center mass energy and these things are more boosted, they're more forward.
Mm-hmm.
The stops tend to be more forward when you produce them.
Mm-hmm.
So the angle is such that they don't make it as far in the transverse direction.
The transverse direction.
So that's why the LHC case is shifted that. Okay, one last possibility. Again, Dirac neutrino masses, forget about this large A-term stuff I described before, but now thermalize the right-handed neutrinos by just invoking some extra U1s, as might show up. In this case, they thought about U1s popping out of an E6 unification scheme. Okay. This is considered by these folks just very recently. So here's the right-handed neutrino mass here. Here's omega h squared. That's W map. This is for different values of the gauge boson mass, the Z prime mass, and linking the Susie breaking mass for the Z prime to the mass for the right-handed guy, right? And so there are basically two ways to get this the abundance right. It's to be down here for a kind of narrow range of light neutrinos, or what did you say?
I say the font is too small.
Oh, is it? Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, so anyway,
it's so
sitting,
easy to drag it bigger.
Anyway, you're sitting on poles.
You're sitting on poles or your light.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it is an eye test.
Yeah, so. actually, Max, you wouldn't mind maybe changing that blind.
Oh, yeah.
I think that would help a lot.
Sure.
Sorry about that. This is the first time I've given this. This is a lesson learned. This is two transparencies, not one. that's right.
Pixels are cheap.
And this can certainly be consistent with CDM mass, especially if you just make the Z prime mass larger, because that's the intermediate state in that scattering diagram. Okay. All right. So there are various ways to sort of gets neutrino dark matter to work out. But I want to go back to the mixing case where you have a largish A term and ask what that might look like at the LHC. So let's try to think about this semi-systematically. You can produce these right-handed neutrinos when you absolutely have to, like in the decays of the NLSP, or maybe you can decay directly down to them from heavier particles. Those are sort of the two ways to produce these things. If theta is really tiny, and I'm going to think of it as being like a tenth or smaller, then obviously, I mean, eventually it's small enough so that nothing will decay to it unless it absolutely has to, right? So that only the NLSP will decay to it. Okay. So that's one useful limit to think about. So in that sense, it seems important to think about the decays of the NLSP because those are the decays that you can kind of count on. On the other hand, these decays of the heavier particles may give you more direct, interesting information about your theory, about the A parameter and about theta. It can give you some more characteristic signatures as well. It's worth thinking about both things. Mostly I'm going to be talking about the decays of the NLSP today.
Okay, so if I think of sine theta of 0.1, that's what you want me to think about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We know it has to be fairly light. Right? How light?
No. Oh, you mean for the dark matter, or
omega. That formula you wrote down.
Right. So I'm going.
We know over 100.
No, I'm glad you brought that up. So I'm going to think about theta as being small, and moreover, this neutrino as being heavy enough so that these annihilations through Higgs can be effective. So 100 GeV. Right, because there were these two.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you're.
So I'm more. I'm
really
I'm skipping this.
Not on that.
I'm going to focus on this today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But theta is going to be large enough so that the NLSP will decay promptly. I'm not going to have any dramatic displaced vertices or charge tracks or anything like that. So, for example, if the NLSP is the lightest neutralino, it would decay into new star, say. And that doesn't look very good, does it? Because this was invisible and seeping into invisible stuff, so you don't get a lot of information from NLSP decays. In this case, the only way you could probe this setup is if you could somehow get heavier stuff to decay directly down to the lightest neutrino. Okay, so suppose that the mostly left-handed neutrino decayed directly down to the lightest neutrino. It can do that by emitting not an H and a Z, but an H or a Z, right? So those are some interesting decays. The left-handed selectron can decay to the right-handed neutrino by emitting a W. Okay. These decays are obviously suppressed by powers of sine theta, right? Because they're sort of coupling to the left-handed parts of this. But they can be competitive with decays to Vino. Yeah. Vino doesn't couple that strongly to things anyway, so it depends on the parameters. So even more promising would be is if you just got rid of the lightest neutrino and you put it up here, if the NLSP was instead the mostly left-handed neutrino, then you could get some very interesting decays. Suppose that the splitting here is relatively large, as my argument before suggested it should be, right? If sine theta is small and the A terms are large enough to get rid of this neutrinos in the early universe, you want these things to be fairly heavy anyway. So in this case, you get decays of this of SNU2 to SNU1 and Higgs, or to SNU1 and Z. This vertex here is just the A term. This is proportional to sine theta, or really sine theta cosine theta. So these vertices are actually telling you something about your model. Okay, so this is definitely promising, and we certainly intend to look into this in some detail, but it's not the case we've looked at so far. What I'm going to be talking about mostly is this case, where the NLSP is the right-handed selectron or slepton. Okay? Imagine that these things, right-handed selectrons, muons, tau, are fairly degenerate. Certainly the first two generations need to be. Of course, we'll take into account left-right mixing for the staus, but think of them as being pretty degenerate. They have to decay into the right-handed centrino if they're NLSP, and there are a couple of ways you can imagine them doing that. You could have right-handed slepton decaying. So I'm sorry. Now the fonts are getting really small. I'll try to.
Well, actually, now that I've got the lights off.
Okay, good. I've got the right-handed slepton here, going into W and SNU1. Okay. Obviously, that is suppressed by sine theta, because I need the left-handed guy there. But look. It's the right-handed slepton going to W. I certainly have that. I mean, so think of this as being slepton 1. That might be sizable for the stau, but it's going to be smaller for this muon and even smaller for this electron. Anyway, you have this competition between this kind of diagram and a three-body diagram through an off-shell neutralino. If you go through an off-shell neutralino, you first get a lepton, then new SNU here. So which of these wins? As I was saying, if you have room for a W, for the stau case, this two-body thing may very well win if tan beta is large enough. And if the flavor of this thing is or the flavors of these things are appropriate, right? I haven't really said anything about how many of these things there are and what flavors they have. But on the other hand, for this muon and Selectron, it's very well motivated to imagine that this is the kind of the dominant decay of the right-handed
it's
Selectron.
It's just not immediately seen. Why is this muon suppressed relative
because,
to the stout?
Because this is the right-handed Selectron.
Yes.
Okay. And so it doesn't couple to, if it were really just purely right-handed, it just would not couple to the W at all, just by virtue
of
being right-handed.
Of course, yes.
So it's only through this mass, it's only through mu, you know, a minus mu tan beta.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Versus m cap. Okay, so I'm doing the 2x2 mixing matrix for the left-handed soft mass and D term, and the right-handed soft mass.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the mixing here is naively just very tiny because it's suppressed by the mu mass. And so therefore, the right-handed, the lightest muon is really right-handed. Okay. And in that case, this vertex is essentially zero. Now when I go to the tau, the mass just got, you know, 20 times bigger.
Yeah.
It's a numerical question.
It's a question.
It's a numerical question, and it's in our code. I mean, it's in our code. You know, we're not, like, just turning this off. But you should think of this as being the default thing that happens for eating here. Okay, what are the signatures of this setup? So this is what I'm going to focus on. Right-handed neutrino LSP, or mostly right-handed neutrino LSP, with NLSP as a right-handed Selectron. Well, obviously, you're going to get a lot of leptons, right? Here's an example where, suppose you produce the chargino that's mostly weno, then it wants to go to left-handed lepton, which goes to, say, lepton neutralino, and then the neutralino decays like this. This is a decay I'm going to care about a lot. Neutralino goes two-body, to say positron Selectron, and then this electron does this three-body thing, right, to electron nu with the off shell vino. Okay. So you tend to get lots of leptons. Okay, good. Can we distinguish this setup from others where you get lots of leptons? Because you certainly can in other CZ setups as well. Here's a very similar looking setup, right? This is a case with low CZ breaking scale, so you have a very light gravitino LSP. And the NLSP is the right-handed Selectron muon stout. Basically, you can imagine that nothing will decay directly to the gravitino. This stuff decays to the gravitino only because there's nothing else to decay to. But if the CZ breaking scale is low enough, these decays will still be prompt, so I won't get any of these tracks or anything like that. So this sounds similar, doesn't it? Because in our case, this mixing is small as well, so I'm imagining kind of that the only thing, you know, most likely the stuff that decays directly are the right-handed leptons. So there are other ways to get leptons, lots of leptons in SUSY models, and I'll come back to another one. But let's just focus on this distinction first, distinguishing from a gravitino LSP with a right-handed lepton NLSP. And you could distinguish by finding evidence for direct decays in our neutrino setup of the non-LS and LSP directly into this neutrino, because that sort of thing doesn't happen for the gravitino case. Or that depends on the parameters in the setup, and we're not going to do that. I'm not going to talk about that today, but you can do it. Or you can just focus on the NLSP decays alone, because we're really just replacing this two-body decay into electron gravitino for the gravitino case with this three-body decay. So what are the differences? Well, on the gravitino side, start with the decay of, suppose you produce the lightest neutralino. Then it decays like this, two-body into positron, Selectron, and the Selectron decays two-body as well. And if you analyze this sequence in the rest frame of the Selectron, it looks like the positron goes flying off and the electron and the neutralino go off in different opposite directions. Right? And there's some angle theta prime. I'm going to think of the rest frame of the right-hand selectron as being the prime frame. There's some theta prime angle between the direction of the electron and the positron, okay, where theta prime is 0, they're in opposite directions. D gamma is just proportional to d cosine theta. The invariant mass of the E plus E minus pair is obviously proportional to, well, energy of this times energy of that times 1 plus cosine theta. This is monoenergetic, but of course in this frame, in the unprime frame, this is not monoenergetic, depends on the angle. And so if you work out the boost, though, it turns out that this is just proportional to the energy of this thing in the prime frame, which is monoenergetic, times 1 plus cosine theta prime. I apologize if this is just stuff that you heard years ago. But anyway, so this is what the invariant mass looks like. And so d gamma, d invariant mass, the shape of the invariant mass distribution, is proportional then, if you look at this equation, to the invariant mass itself. So if I plot the event rate versus the invariant mass, it just looks like a straight line like that. And then there's some endpoint, the maximum value, which you get when things go off in opposite directions. So that's what you get in the Gravitino case, or so you'd expect. Agreed? In, and yeah, and notice the form of the endpoint, the Gravitino mass is essentially zero, so this is really what you have. Okay. I'm going to accelerate a little bit here. In this neutrino case, you start out with the two-body decay of the same lattice neutralino, then the right-handed thing goes to a three-body decay. So it's not just that E plus E minus come from a three-body decay rather than a two-body one, it's that they come from one two-body followed by a three-body. Okay. And if you analyze this, I'll spare you the details of this, there's some integration you have to do in your Dalitz plot. And in the massless neutrino limit, you get some simple form for the distribution, the invariant mass distribution. And the distribution shifts to lower values as the neutrino mass increases. Let me just show you some plots. So in basically the limit of the of massless neutrino, you just have this sort of almost symmetric looking thing. As you turn on this neutrino mass now, it just shifts a little bit this way, although not very dramatically. This is where the select, where the off-shell neutralino is twice as heavy as the selectron. Okay, that was assuming constant amplitude before. We've included the amplitude effects, which are not very dramatic for this these decays, as it turns out. They can be if you tune things to be very close to each other, but okay. So these plots I hope suggest to you that probably it shouldn't be too hard to distinguish this Gravitino LSP case from the neutrino LSP case, right? Just two body kinematics versus the kinematics that give you softer distributions in the invariant mass. That's the idea. The other case we're trying to compare with is one where you instead have a neutralino LSP and you get three-body decays of a heavier neutralino down to that LSP through, say, an off-shell selectron. Okay. That's a good way to get lots of leptons, obviously. And moreover, since you have a three-body decay, you might expect that the invariant mass distributions would match up better with this neutrino case. So that's another case we want to distinguish. And you can take the amplitude to be constant for this case, derive the shape of the invariant mass distribution. It depends on the ratio of, you know, x here is just the invariant mass divided by its maximum value, the endpoint value. K here is the mass of this LSP divided by the splitting between those things. And so the interesting thing is that if you turn K off, if you just make this thing massless, you get the same shape distribution as you got previously for this neutrino case. So that sounds bad. It sounds like they look the same. But as you turn K on, even a little bit, the distribution changes rather rapidly. So if you make it infinite or very large, you get these steeper edges. This looks more like the Gravitino case, right? Sort of more triangular a little bit. But, you know, it looks different qualitatively even for k of about 0.1. So that's lightest neutralino.
What is k again? The ratio?
K is the lightest neutralino mass. So m pi 1. M pi 1 over this difference. Oops, I'm going to put this. So I'm interested in the case where, you know, this second heaviest neutralino, second lightest neutralino is going free body to this thing in lepton pairs. Okay. So, you know, 0.1 is telling you that this thing is very light and this thing is very heavy. Okay. So you see one way to get a soft and very mass distribution with an endpoint is to take the LSP to be very light for a three-body decay. Another way, think about this. Suppose you make your off-shell electron mass, bring it down not far above the chi-2 mass. What happens then? So this can almost decay into these things, but this is just slightly off-shell. Then it's kind of like you can just convert to these things, right? You convert to this, give off a very soft positron, and then this subsequently decays. And so if you include this effect, you find that you can soften the distribution by making this nearly degenerate with that. Right, so this number allows you to make those masses degenerate. This number allows you to make the LSP mass very light. Right? So here, I'm starting with a very light LSP mass, and I get sort of a similar symmetric distribution looking distribution, similar to the one I had before for the neutrino case. And as I increase this neutrino mass, it's still, the neutralino mass, it still becomes harder like that. Or I can take this reasonable value, this mild value for chi1 or chi2, and just tune this to be pretty close to 1. And then starting from here this electron mass is twice as heavy as this electron mass here. I draw the diagram. This electron mass here is twice as heavy as the chi2. If I bring them close to each other, you can see that indeed this distribution softens. And I have to get pretty precise to make it really soft and fully. But so what I want to suggest is that these invariant mass distributions should be able to distinguish these different cases. Should be able to distinguish this neutrino case from the right-handed lepton case. This neutrino case from the Gravitino case, because in the Gravitino case you have that hard edge. And I would say the most, in most cases, it can distinguish from the chi1 LSP case, where you have this three-body decay. You only run into trouble when this ratio is very small, or the intermediate electron is nearly degenerate with chi2. These cases, you can usually get a different. There are other ways to get a handle on these cases. For instance, if this is the case where when chi2 decays through the off shell electrons, if this mass is just above that mass, typically this electron, or often you'll get a lot of soft positrons here. So you get a lot of soft leptons. In this case, suppose, you know, I'll just measure the endpoint. Suppose the endpoint turns out to be rather small, like 70 GeV. What is that telling me for this three-body case? It's telling me that m chi 2 minus m chi 1 is equal to 70 GeV. But then, if that mass plane is 70 GeV, then it's rather hard. It's rather hard for me to have this ratio be very small, because in that case, both particles have to have masses, say, below 100 GeV, and you run into problems with charging and searches and so forth. So it's hard for this thing to be small in certain cases, not in all cases, but.
Okay, so I'm running out of time, so I'll tell you a little bit about the simulations we did. We've only simulated signal stuff. We haven't even gotten to backgrounds. But there is this nice SUSYHIT package to calculate particle spectra and SUSY models and branching ratios, which we've adapted to include this right-handed citrino, including these funny three-body decays and other decays. So far, we're just setting parameters at the weak scale, although we might want to look at sort of more high-scale specific theories. And we're running things through Pythia for initial finite state radiation and patternization. And then running those things through the PGS detector simulator. And here's a sample point that we took for this neutrino LSP case. What do I care about? I want this to be 100 GeV and the mixing to be 0.1. That was kind of the point that I said I was going to focus on. And then that told me from that abundance plot that this lepton, left-handed lepton, has to be pretty heavy, so I have it up here at 450 GeV. Okay. So this is the kind of spectrum that you have, taking the sporks to be like 500 GeV. The Luino's at 600. And this is what you get when you, after the detector simulator, you require that your event has a single pair of either E plus E minus or mu plus mu minus. Okay? And you look at the invariant mass of those pairs. This is the distribution you get. And the thing you notice, again, is a sort of symmetric looking distribution as you'd expect based on the calculations. You have all this background from the signal that you could get rid of by subtracting off different flavor combinations, which we just haven't even looked at.
These realistic statistics that we're looking at?
Oh, yeah, they are. This is actually very little statistics. My computer was so slow. I have a light spectrum, right? So that helps. I mean,
yeah.
It's... So for this... So keep in mind what my Gluino and Squark are. But this is after 40,000 events. So that's... You know, this is like 30 picobarn cross-section. So this is after about an inverse femtobarn, or a little more. Okay. Another variable you might be interested in is the ratio of the missing PT to sort of the scalar sum of all the PTs. And this is what it looks like for this neutrino case. Of course, the largest it can be is 0.5. It doesn't change much whether you're looking at the part of the part of the signal with these. These same events where I required a opposite sign, same flavor pair, versus just all the events together, right? You get a very similar looking distribution. Okay. Now, for the Gravitino case, I took out the right-handed neutrino and replaced it with a massless. So just the same spectrum except with the neutrino. When you do that, the endpoint shifts. So I didn't adjust the other masses to get the same endpoint. But the point is you get a very qualitatively different looking spectrum, which is good. Okay. Here's the case where we looked at for the neutralino. So before I had 200, I tried to make a few changes. Before I had 200, 400, 600 to get a similar looking endpoint to the one I had for the neutrino case, which is an 80 GeV endpoint, I changed 400 to 80, basically. And what else did I say? And I wanted Chi2 to be the NLSP, because I wanted this thing to have three body decays. So I took it down there.
I require that this thing, required by hand, that this thing decays leptonically. It's kind of hard to make this work. So just to be able to compare spectra, I did that. And you get this spectrum, which looks fairly much like the Gravitino case, because chi-1 is not particularly light, and the right-handed selectron is not particularly degenerate with chi-2. Okay. All right, so that's good. That looks distinguishable. On the other hand, if I bring the neutralino mass down to 40 GeV now, so I just by hand bring it all the way down to 40 GeV, now it is really light, and you do get a similar-looking spectrum in the invariant mass distribution. So you need to look at other things to get a handle on the difference between these things. One obvious thing is that here's what happens for our neutrino model quite often. You produce, say, a right-handed spore, which decays into Eliza neutralino, end of story. Oh, I'm sorry, what am I talking about? This happens often in this Eliza neutralino case. Right-handed spore goes to Eliza neutralino and quark. For us, we can't do this, right? We need a long, convoluted series of decays to get down to the LSB neutrino. If I were going to do this in our case, I would need to then do LSB minus. That's neutrino like that. Oops. No. So basically, it's a lot less direct to the LSP. And so if you look at that R variable that I showed you at before, remember, it really died off for this neutrino case. Here, it doesn't die off nearly as quickly. So there's that distinction. In fact, the lepton content in these samples will also be very different. Okay. So let me conclude. The mixed neutrino is a viable dark matter candidate. The question that I want to look at is how it can be distinguished from other LSP scenarios at colliders, specifically the LHC. And we started by looking at the case where the NLSP is a right-handed slepton, and the invariant mass distributions of opposite sign, same flavor dileptons are very interesting things to look at. For this neutrino case, they're significantly shifted away from the kinematic endpoint. That makes them look very different from the Gravitino case. Three-body decays of heavier neutralinos to neutralino LSPs can look similar, but there are other features in those frameworks which will distinguish those cases, we think. So what we really need to work on is simulating some backgrounds as well. We also want to look at these other, maybe even more interesting signatures, although they might be a little less generic, and also think about the impact that larger mixing angles might have. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
One thing to keep in mind with the endpoints and the edges is that if you ever get one near 80 or 90 GeV.
Yeah, there's the Z stuff. And
it gets very difficult because of the Z.
So I should have chosen a different example.
So that's the big problem with this LM1 point, the things at CMS, is that the edge is right at the Z. So it makes it much harder to...
Because you basically have to cut around those.
Yeah.
If you cut the invariant mass there anyway to get rid of the background. So, okay.
To what extent is SUSY its own background in this case? I mean, if you mix together a number of channels,
it's very parameter dependent. This is full SUSY production that I'm doing with Pythia here. Mm-hmm. So it's all in there. you see background here.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Great fun. To
but yeah, for example, for this chi-0 neutralino case, one thing that happens a lot is you produce chi plus and chi minus. And they go to leptons and
right.
compare
it.
They do not do the same
thing
flavor. And so, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's there.
You have just about 80, that down there, 70, event 80, then 500. Is that?
So it's 500 events here.
You're comparing with a different plot where it was
yeah,
much smaller?
Let's see. That's because the lepton contents are different, I think. Was this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This is for 40,000 events for both of them, but the lepton contents were different, which is good because ultimately that can help you distinguish these things as well.
Can be enhanced to same. Can be enhanced.
The lepton content?
Event, number of events.
Oh, yeah. You mean if I generated more events,
oh, yeah.
it would help my plots? Is that what you're saying? Yes.
Yeah,
yeah, no, I mean, this isn't that much statistics, so I just ran out of time and didn't. Yeah.
You thought about high scale theories that might give you a light right hand that's not trivial?
Well, it's not that. Is it that unusual? Like, I mean, if you have.
I was asking.
Yeah. In Gugino mediation, what happens if you have a high compactification scale there? I think very often the right-handed lepton is the
well, that's not a very high scale theory. You're still in the T. You're still mediating it.
No. Gugino mediation with the really gut scale compactification. can you confirm or deny this? Do you know whether this is true? If you do Gugino mediation with a gut scale compactification radius, what is the LSP there?
LSP.
Is it the right-handed electron, or is it the right-handed stow, or is it the Beano?
Yeah.
I seem to remember there's a competition, right? Like
yeah.
That's pretty
yeah.
close.
Usually.
Yeah. So that's part of why we wanted to focus on that case, is we thought that it was a pretty plausible one. I mean, the first one I was thinking about was the neutralino LSP, but it seems so challenging that we decided to do something easier.
Okay.
Thank you.